Well, you know, podcast family, that here on this show, we don't steer away from controversial stuff as long as there's some kind of evidence, and especially if there's societal guidance, we're all over it, even though we don't always have to agree. Well, this is a little bit controversial because this whole topic of female low T, especially for decreased sexual interest disorder, is a big deal. It's all over social media, which we know, of course, is the home to evidence-based medicine. Sarcasm. So I thought we got to cover this because it's so prevalent. So prevalent. I don't know about you, but I do have patients who come in. I'm talking like 25-year-olds who are like, hey, I saw on TikTok, you know, I don't really get in the mood that much with my boyfriend. Can I have some testosterone? To which my professional, compassionate answer is, hell no, I'm not giving you testosterone. Especially when you haven't had bilateral oophorectomy and you haven't been worked up for some other cause. But this is a big deal. So, yes, we're going there. We're entering the forest of controversy, but there are some big, big names here. And I don't mean individuals. I mean big societies that have put in their vote on this topic. So we're going to cover this. Plus, we're going to talk about a couple of big societal guidances that really should answer the question for us. All right. So lots to cover. No doubt, without question, there's a strong debate within the medical community about whether or not testosterone should be used to women either postmenopausal or in the reproductive age for decreased sexual interest disorder. It's a big deal. Just look anywhere on social media because influencers are shown, they go online, they're rubbing their little testosterone cream in their arm, and they're like, oh, ready for the day. Stop doing that. Stop doing that. This is not the cure-all for all things abnormal. But some sites, I'm not going to mention, some social media sites have proclaimed the wonders of testosterone. And I'm going to be honest here, guys, there's a role for that in women in the appropriate context, and that's very restricted. Now, I'm going to talk about it in this episode. But when it's advocated as a cure-all for mood, sex drive, cognitive function, fatigue, reduced muscle strength, I'm going to talk on that one in a minute, whether you're in menopause or not, we've got to set the record straight. So, I don't know what you're doing in your practice. It's not up to me. I'm not going to get after you. You do you. But especially if you're doing testosterone pellets and they're in reproductive age, I'm shaking my head at you right now because we're going to talk about the data and we're going to talk about the one possible formulation that could help here. Now, it's true, in the United States, we don't have a specific FDA-approved testosterone product for decreased sexual interest, but we do have two medications that are FDA-approved in the premenopausal side. But, you know, some of the data there is meh, but we'll talk about that briefly as well, all right? So we do have two FDA-approved medications for decreased sexual interest disorder in premenopause, but nothing that's testosterone-based on either side of the fence, right? Pre- or postmenopause. The only country right now that does have something approved for postmenopausal women is Australia. That is a 1% testosterone little cream, and we'll talk about that in a minute. Steve, if you're listening, Steve is a good friend through our podcast in Australia. Love to get your thoughts on this, if you're using this, if this is popular for use in Australia, because it would be eaten up over here in the United States. But even with that, there are restrictions from an international guidance, okay? So you just can't be doing this willy-nilly. You can't put this on like it's deodorant every day. I mean, this is a restricted and very directed guidance on this subject, okay? So we're going to talk about all of this. So here's the question. Even though testosterone prescriptions for women have been on the rise in the last 5 years, all right? Actually, it's been about 7 years, but in the last five specifically, boom, it's just increased, even though it's all off-label, right? Because we don't have anything FDA approved in the States. Even though prescriptions have increased, not just in the U.S., Canada, the U.K., Australia, I mean, it's worldwide, because social media is worldwide. Even though those prescriptions have increased and we have objective numbers, we can look at the data and say, wow, that we are definitely using this in women a lot more. is that evidence-based? Now, I want to focus on decreased sexual interest disorder, okay? The old hypoactive sexual desire disorder, right? HSDD, hypoactive sexual desire disorder, which has been renamed, and we'll get into that as well. So, is that evidence-based? And the answer, here it is, guys, here's a spoiler, is yes. Yeah. Oh, you didn't think I was going to say that, did you? The answer is yes. And the answer is no. So it is both. And I'm going to explain in this episode. So can testosterone, ideally transdermal, can it help with female sexual interest disorder? Yes, absolutely. And no. I love it. Now, I'm going to get to the, how's that for a teaser? We're going to explain all of this in this episode. We're going to talk about an international guidance from an international coalition from 2019. We're going to talk about a separate position statement in 2021. And of course, you know, I've got to give ACOG's 2 cents in here. So we will do that. So two major position statements from 2019, 2021, which is the last one, and then ACOG's from their practice bulletin. And we've got lots of data to cover. All right, everybody, go lather yourself up with your favorite testosterone cream. Grab a seat and listen to this episode because we got lots of fun stuff to cover. Here we go. Just trying to keep everyone up to date on evidence-based practice because medicine moves real fast. This is Clinical Pearls.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Duh, social media. You gotta love it and you hate it at the same time. We're trying to do something through our social media channels that's helpful. We're trying to be evidence-based. We follow guidance. We try to give you the references. We're trying to help here, but sometimes there's the other group is just sending out some whack stuff. And it's not evidence-based, guys. We have an episode in the past called How TikTok is Killing the IUD because very rare the person that goes on TikTok and goes, oh, I just had the IUD. It wasn't that bad. Yeah, there's some out there, but the majority are those that are saying, oh my gosh, I felt like my left foot was getting amputated. What? I mean, look, don't throw IUDs under the bus because of somebody's bad placement technique or because of a natural endogenous low pain level. I mean, you don't know people's situation and what that placement was actually like. All to say, not only should we get our medical information from evidence-based, reputable sources, but we should tell our patients to do the same thing. We're doing this topic because somebody sent me, one of my contacts at another institution, sent me this link to a social media site, won't tell you which one, where this lady was giving her little testimonial. I mean, this is exactly what she said, guys. Well, not exactly, but you know what I'm saying. Paraphrased, she's putting on her little testosterone cream on her arm, and she was giving this testimonial how she just did that yesterday, the day before, and oh my goodness, I mean, like she had like the best sex ever. I mean, if you listen to that video, it's like, oh my goodness, you apply this testosterone cream and like Marvin Gaye like magically appears and starts singing to you. Come on. Probably not. And if you had great, fantastic, eye-rolling sex, good for you. I don't know necessarily if that was the testosterone cream that you applied. But, hey, c'est la vie. So this is why we're doing this, because I got this this message and I responded back to my contact. I'm like, come on, man. You got to be kidding me. He said, look, this is a real thing. This lady's got thousands of views. And I just thought maybe you'd want to, you know, address this as a medical education point. So which I said, hell yeah. Because it would be great if Marvin Gaye's songs like Follow Me Everywhere I Went as a soundtrack, but that's just not the way it is. So let's set the record straight, talking about first the term, because hypoactive sexual desire disorder, HSDD, is no longer a term. So let's get into the correct terminology, then we're going to hit the data hard, because we got lots to do here. If you read some of the guidance, it's amazing that even as late as 2021 and 2022, where the AUA gave a little commentary on this topic, which basically said, hey, I point you to the 2021 guidance, which we're going to talk about. But even the AUA says, for female HSDD, well, I get that. It's easy to understand hypoactive sexual desire disorder, but that's just not the correct term. The correct term is now a combined term, which is female interest arousal disorder, all right? That replaced the DSM-IV term, hypoactive sexual desire disorder. So when you read some stuff, it's like a little pet peeve that it's like IUD for Mirena. It's not an IUD. Y'all know my little rant on that. That is not a device. The Mirena family is an intrauterine system. It's a drug delivery system. So the term hypoactive sexual desire disorder, HSDD, isn't a thing anymore. That died with DSM-IV. So the combined term is female interest arousal disorder, although just to be clear, what I'm talking about here is specifically focusing on female interest disorder. Okay, the arousal stuff is even more controversial and more gray, and the orgasm data has zero tie to testosterone. This mainly has to do with female decrease interest disorder. And if HSDD, hypoactive sexual desire, kind of slips out during this episode, it's because old habits die hard. I am trying to be very conscious of that, but even when I'm talking to patients, and we've gone through the entire workup, and I tell them, hey, you know, there's a real diagnostic code here. ACOG recognizes our professional society. It's called hypoactive sexual desire disorder. Oh, wait. I mean, it's not that. It used to be called that. Now it's called female interest arousal disorder. So just to be clear, that the terms change with DSM-5. And now the other thing that we have to tell patients. So number one, it is a legit thing when it applies after a complete, guys. And here's a 3-prong approach that ACOG, the AUA, FIGO all agree with, which is this discussion of decreased female sexual desire disorder has to be evaluated with a 3-prong approach. Okay, the 3-prong approach is called the biopsychosocial evaluation. How about that? So is it a biological issue? There's something else going on. Biopsychosocial, the psycho part is there some kind of mental behavioral health disorder? So is it depression, which typically there's a big factor there? Is it anxiety? Is it a sexual aversion issue? Where does that fit in? And of course, the social is the inter-partner relationship, life stressors. So biopsychosocial evaluation means that 3 different distinct boxes have to be evaluated for a patient to say, look, you fit this diagnosis. We've got to now evaluate those 3 things in order to see what's the best treatment for you. And it's not testosterone carte blanche. Like, don't feel like having sex? Rub this, you're on your arm, honey. You're going to knock it out of the park. Can't say that. It's super, super controversial, yet at the same time, super, super clear. Okay. Plus, especially if your patient is premenopausal, we have to let them know, look, I understand there's this decreased sexual desire thing happening. We've taken a look at the biopsychosocial aspect. And I have to tell you that there are 2 FDA-approved medications for this, again, under the menopausal state. Okay, so if you are before menopause, okay, prior to menopause, there are 2 medications that you can try, although their data is less than impressive, and they've got some issues, right? Remember that the first one is Addy, that's called flibanserin, and then the second one is Vilesi, and I think we have a podcast on Vilesi, I'm sure of it, which is bremelanotide. Okay, so Vilesi is an oral medication, and remember that Vilesi, bremelanotide, is actually an injection. It's self-administered. It takes about 45 minutes to get the gears going, if you know what I mean. And their data is okay. It's not great, but at least it's something. And in terms of their mechanism of action, remember that these are two different agents, okay? Ada, or flibanserin, is a serotonin 1A receptor agonist, and a serotonin 2A receptor antagonist. Y'all got that? All right, so flibanserin works on the serotonin system 1A agonist, so it helps that, and then serotonin 2A receptor antagonist, it blocks that. Now, even though we've got plenty of data, and we're not going to get into the biochemistry of this, we know how it works on serotonin as an agonist-antagonist, we're not really sure how it improves sexual desire. Like, I don't know if SSRIs kind of decrease desire, maybe by blocking the serotonin 2A receptor, because it's an antagonist there, we can kick it up a notch. That's the thought, but it's really unclear. Vilesi, or bremelanotide, is a melanocortin receptor agonist. How about that? Like, melanocortin is involved with sexual desire? Apparently, at least indirectly, because we're not sure once this this medication non-selectively hits those receptors, the melanocortin receptors, what happens further on down the chain? It seems to be polyagonistic, okay? And most of that has to do with the melanocortin receptor number 4. That's the one that's mainly activated with sexual response. Now, the good news about this injection is that it seems to work like 24 hours. But there's nothing sexier than saying, hold on, honey, let me go get my shot and give me about 45 minutes. Hey, if it works, great. But again, the data is, it's not all that great, but it's something. But neither of these are testosterone-based. The U.S. does not have a testosterone-based medication, whether for pre or for post-menopause, for this condition, right? For decreased female sexual interest disorder. The only ones that have it are the Australians, okay? So in 2020, their FDA passed for the first time this 1% testosterone cream for decreased sexual drive, but it's only for postmenopausal women. Now, if you're thinking, that's not very nice. I mean, what about premenopause? Well, there's a lot of issues with premenopause. And the issue with premenopause is that you've got to rule out a lot of stuff first, and you got to make darn sure that they're not at risk for pregnancy, because anything that's androgenic like this, or DHEA, which as a supplement does not work, there's your spoiler, even though those things are plenty on the shelf in the U.S. Go to any Walgreens, because I've done this. I like to go investigate stuff. And so I look, I'm like, there's DHEA, because it's going to get somehow activated and converted to testosterone in the body. Well, it does. It does that naturally. But whether supplements work after a first pass conversion, it's very unclear. And there's zero evidence that taking DHEA boosts natural testosterone. Sorry, guys. It just doesn't work. And the data is not there. But if you take DHEA in reproductive age or testosterone, and there's a chance of pregnancy, those are potentially bad because of the effect on the developing genitalia, especially during organogenesis, okay? So that is why this was for postmenopausal women. And that's why the 2019 International Consortium that we're going to talk about in a minute says this is for use in postmenopause. Postmenopause. Now, there is another society that says maybe you can extend that to late reproductive age, like over the age of 45. But again, nobody has any kind of guidance for use in reproductive age women. So if your 25 or 28 year old comes in and says, I saw the video on X channel and she rubbed testosterone on her arm and she had eye rolling sex and I want that, your job should be, nope, negativo, not going to happen, sister. And here's why. Because we got to talk through these things. Too many questions. In the otherwise healthy reproductive age patient, all right? So remember the answer I gave you at the beginning. Does testosterone work for decreased sexual interest? And I said yes and no. The answer is yes, especially for postmenopause. And we're going to get into the no in a minute. Now, The reason that the 2021 guidance, which I'll give you in a minute, extends to the late reproductive age is because chance of pregnancy now is much lower and they're closer to that transition. So maybe try it there. But I'll be very clear. Nobody has guidance or approval or states that in young reproductive age women, testosterone should be given. Okay. So if you're 30, 35, and unless and not had bilateral oophorectomy, this should not be done. It shouldn't be done, and definitely not in pellet form. That's an ex-nay. I'm going to get into that in a minute. Again, if you're doing that in your practice, look, man, you do you. I've got to adhere to the data, okay? But pellets are known to give supraphysiological dosages of which we have zero long-term data, and the real concern here, both for breast health, cardiovascular issues, and possibly irreversible changes, including masculinization. Okay, well, I'll get into that in a minute. A lot of questions here, but just wanted to give that info. That cream from Australia is called Androfem. It's a 1% cream in Australia. So if you're traveling to Sydney, try to pick yourself some up. Bring it back if it's allowed. And right now in the U.S. and the U.K., it's no go, although the U.K. is trying to get an exchange kind of program there to get some meds over off-label until the U.K. approves. All right, that was a lot of info. So Addie, again, has some issues, mainly with hypertension if mixed with alcohol. And even Vilesi has some side effects like headaches. There's vomiting. You can get hot flushes. There's nasal congestion. It makes you really dizzy if you're prone to dizziness, which are all symptoms. When I think about getting in the mood, I think of those symptoms exactly, don't you? Oh, my gosh. So this just goes to show, guys, decreased sexual interest is a big deal. And I'm not trying to minimize this at all. Man, it's a big deal. In a relationship, unless you both have by mutual decision decided to push sexual intimacy down the road, because, hey, who am I to judge? But in otherwise, physical relationship, I mean, intimacy is a big deal. I mean, that's the few things that you share with your partner that you don't share with others. I'd hope you wouldn't. So it's a big deal, all right? So I'm not trying to minimize this at all. I'm just trying to say that there's other agents. And beyond that, you got to get to the root of the issue. Everybody wants a quick fix, and testosterone may not be it, especially in the reproductive age patient. I'm also going to address in a little bit testosterone, because this has also been on social media. If it's not being advocated for sexual wellness, it's being advertised for women on social media channels to help build muscle mass. Oh my goodness, please don't do that. You know how you build muscle mass? The old-fashioned way. That's called exercise and weight training. It just sucks. It just is. Now, will you build muscle by taking testosterone? Oh, for sure. But typically, it has to be supraphysiological dosages where the risks do not justify the benefits. So if you want to get ripped and toned up, may have to do it the old-fashioned way. So just throwing that out there for a minute. But we'll talk about one of the guidances that touched on that in just a minute. All right, let that settle in. I think we've talked about a lot already. When we come back, we're going to talk about what are normal, quote, unquote, normal levels in men and what are, quote, unquote, normal serum levels in females. And what does the data say about correlation between levels and female sexual interest? Let's talk about that next. Thank you for being part of our podcast family. We really are grateful and thankful that you've chosen to take this journey of medical education with us. You're listening to Clinical Pearls.
Deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
All right, now, in general and in reproductive age, assuming somebody doesn't have hyperandrogenemia, of course, And assuming that the patient has not had bilateral oophorectomy, which is the one catch where maybe in premenopausal patients who have had a BSO, which the question is, again, why would you be doing that anyway? You've got to have a severe issue going on there because we don't do bilateral oophorectomy in the reproductive age unless there's a big reason, right? But in that one caveat, if you do a bilateral oophorectomy, then the chance of pregnancy is zero. And because there's a quick precipitous drop in endogenous testosterone, like 50% of baseline, in order to protect wellness, then you can consider giving estrogen and testosterone together. But testosterone, the same rules apply. And I'm going to get into that in a minute. The same rules apply because this is not going to continue for years, guys. All right. So is there a place for testosterone replacement in reproductive age women? Yes, if they had bilateral oophorectomy. But again, the same rules apply. What are those rules? I'll give it to you in a minute. So assuming that that's not the issue, the levels are as follows. In an average male, look at this spread, anywhere from 300 up to 1,000 nanograms per deciliter, NG per DL, 300 to 1,000, okay? Females, again, assuming they're not hyperandrogenemic from some other etiology, that level is like 15 to 70 nanograms per deciliter. Big differences, right? So males, 300 to 1,000, females, 15 to 70. That's a big deal here. So look at that big spread. But the question is this, and here is the caveat. We don't know at what level for females, what level it would actually trigger decreased female sexual interest disorder. Okay, we don't know that. Is it 5? Is it 10? We have zero information for that. Plus, look at this rebuttal. Look at this clinical example here and tell me if this is why this doesn't make sense in reproductive age, all right? Let's say a woman has a true serum diagnosed hyperandrogenemia. So for a woman, let's say that her level is like 90 or 100, okay? That's above the typical female level of 15 to 70. Remember, males is 300 to 1,000. Now, if you've got levels that are like overtly high, like over 750 or 800, I mean, you've got to do an eval to make sure it's not an androgen-secreting ovarian tumor or an adrenal tumor. But again, those are very rare. So let's just say she's got hyperandrogenemia at the upper end of normal for female, right? So she's got more androgen slash testosterone, okay? So is that patient or are these patients who are hyperandrogenemic, are they hypersexual? I mean, are they just waiting to get it on multiple times a day? Well, maybe some of them are. I don't know. I mean, people are different. But in general, the answer is what? No. So do y'all get that? So the extrapolation is that if female sexual interest is absolutely only related to serum testosterone, why are not all of our PCOS patients who have high testosterone levels above the female range, but not in the pathological like cancer range, why are they not just like hypersexual? Again, people are different, some may be, but that's about making the point here that female sexual response and desire is not just testosterone driven. Is it testosterone driven to a degree? Absolutely. But it's not the only factor. In other words, it is a factor. Do y'all get that? So I explain this to patients all the time when they come in asking for tea, if, you know, hey, can I have some extra testosterone? Because I saw it on social media website. And I'm happy to check. I'm like, you know what? Let's check a level. If you're not on any kind of hormonal suppression, let's see where you're at. Let's just do it for gibbies, okay, for educational purposes. And if it's in that mid to normal range, I show them, look, there's nothing. And then I tell them this story about PCOS. Look, we've got patients who have high testosterone levels, higher than a female, typical female range, but not pathological, and they're not hypersexual. So just because I increase the level doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be in the mood for the boudoir much, much more. Okay, so that's an important point to consider. It is a cause of female sexual interest disorder, not the only cause. All right, plus, here it is, guys, as a clinical pearl. Remember, it's complicated. Low sexual desire is multifaceted, especially for women. Social factors, medical issues, other medications, like if they're on an SSRI. Even though it's super controversial, and I realize that some of this data is out there, some progestin-only birth control may potentially decrease libido, even though that's super controversial, because of ovarian suppression. I get that. Like Depo-Provera, I mean, that's a big wet blanket on the ovaries, right? Same thing as Nexplanon. It kind of suppresses ovarian function to a degree. But the data is super controversial, all right? But the main thing is that there's life stressors, partner relationships. There's other things like depression possibly going on. So I'm making the point here that unless the patient is reproductive age and had bilateral oophorectomy for something else, in which case there's got other issues going on, right? And if that's the case, she definitely needs estrogen replacement for sure. But if testosterone is going to be used, unless there's a contraindication, it's not going to be forever. It's got to be for like 3 to 6 months, and that's it. Guys, all the guidances, here it is. One of the restrictive uses is that this is only for short term, where everyone is afraid, at least the evidence-based folks are afraid, of using this for more than 6 months because there is zero data. We don't know. And plenty of true valid concerns for fear, like irreversible changes that ACOG gets into, I'm going to tell you about, like cardiovascular changes, like decrease in HDL and bad lipoprotein development profiles. And above all, things that affect vasculature compliance and even hirsutism, acne, and possibly even clitoromegaly, all right? So these are real issues that nobody has data for. So it's very hard to say, hey, you can be on this for years. That's not correct. And if you're giving this in a supraphysiological dose, you're against guideline, okay? Sorry, guys, not trying to piss anybody off. I'm just trying to say what it is. The majority of the data, which led to the three different stances that we're going to talk here about, the 2019 guidance, the 2021 guidance, and ACOGS, say that if you're going to do some kind of testosterone, it should be transdermal, and it should be kept, level should be kept at the mid-range for females, never in the male range. That's called supraphysiologic. Now that we're talking about levels, we have to remember and tell patients this, that there is a natural, the reality is this, guys, there's a natural decrease in testosterone levels in both men and women as people age. That's physiologic and not pathologic, right? And as I've mentioned before, the only real caveat to that is premenopausal bilateral oophorectomy, where there's a 50% drop. But here's what ACOG says and ASRM regarding androgen levels in women. ACOG and ASRM both state that androgen levels peak in the mid-20s and then they start their decline until around the mid-30s and they keep slowly going down until around the age of 60. Now, at 60, they kind of plateau and there's no further decrease, all right? So they peak in mid-20s, kind of take a little rocky step downwards, kind of step ladder down until the mid-30s. And then keep a slow progression downward until around age 60. Oh, here's your warning. Basic science info coming up next. Basic science info coming up next. In women, testosterone is produced by various locations. One quarter of the hormone is produced by the ovary. One quarter is produced by the adrenal, and one half is actually produced in the peripheral tissues from the various precursors produced from those two sites, the ovaries and the adrenals. In the ovary, the main precursor is androstenedione, which is also primarily converted to estrone, but also has a path towards androgen development. The other precursor in the adrenal is DHEA and DHEAS. So the ovary, as a direct contributor to testosterone, is only one quarter. But that drop, that 50% drop after reproductive age bilateral oophorectomy, the reason it's 50% is because although one quarter is true testosterone produced by the ovary, the other contribution of that is the precursors from the ovarian tissue. All right, that's about the extent of basic science that I can stand. So back to the clinical stuff. Now, here's another logistical issue that can be an obstacle in prescribing testosterone right now to women. It's just the way it is for us in the U.S., okay? Is that testosterone is a scheduled medication. Okay, so I don't mean schedule like in terms of when you take it. I mean, it's a scheduled drug, all right? So right now it's under a Schedule 3 medication. If you forgot what that is, that's those that have a moderate degree of dependence, either physical or psychological. And you're like, where did that come from? Man, that goes back to the 90s. Okay, in 1990, Congress added testosterone to the Controlled Substances Act as level 3, and it had nothing to do with what we're talking about here. At that time, there was a lot of the doping scandal going on, and there was testosterone being used, obviously off-label, for muscle mass and athletic performance. So it was added to a Schedule 3. Again, mind you, estrogen is not on that schedule. So there has been, really since like 2021, 2022, a push to take that out of Schedule 3 and either put it on Schedule 4, which says low potential for abuse, or to deschedule it altogether, just to take it off the Controlled Substances Act. But just be aware, it is, you know, there's that issue. So anyway, it is what it is. All right, so let's get back to the question. Can it help? What is the data that testosterone can help with the old HSDD, or now the term decreased female sexual interest disorder? Well, there is. It is absolutely, it's unequivocal that testosterone, as long as it stays in the physiological range, absolutely can help with sexual fantasies, helps with sexual interest. It helps with that. There's no question. It's an anabolic, androgenistic, obviously, duh, steroid that hits the brain. It does. The catch is the data is only in short-term use. It's only been, the data that has come out has been for like 3 months up to 6 months, and then people stop looking because like, we're not getting into that. So here's the question, and here's the ethical dilemma. And then why the debate, like we said in the intro, why the debate is real. Are we kicking the can down the road? And what's going to happen in 6 months? All right, so you have 6 months of maybe some better libido. You can't use this medication forever. That's the problem, is have you gotten to the root of it? Hence the three-prong approach here, biopsychosocial, to see what is at play here. But does it work? Absolutely. Now that we've laid that and then said yes, it does work. If done correctly, and then now we've opened up the doors, we're entering into the courtroom of the two professional societies that agree and disagree at the same time. Okay, so one was from 2019, the other from 2021. So let's start with 2019. This was an aggregate statement of a variety of different societies that gave a much more conservative take on its use compared to the 2021 guidance, which I'm also going to tell you about in a minute. Okay, so let's start with 2019. Now, let me just tell you who endorsed this. Now, this was a clinical practice guidance on the use of testosterone in women. And these are all the societies, listen to this, just so you know, this is pretty darn heavy, who endorsed this, okay? And this has kind of been the last word, the last revision that has happened, 2019, with the little side note of 2021 from a different society. So in 2019, here's all the people that said, we'll put our name behind it. It's pretty big. So we have NAMS, now called the Menopause Society. That was the North American Menopause Society. We've got the Royal College of OBGYN. We've got RANSCOG. Well, you're like, who? Come on, man, RANSCOG. That's New Zealand and Australia. So they're on this. The International Menopause Society, the Endocrine Society, the European Menopause and Andropause Society, the International Society for Sexual Medicine, the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health, the Federation of Latin American Societies for Menopause, the International Society of Endocrinology, and the Endocrine Society of Australia. Wowzers. Okay, so all of those international bodies came together and said, here's what we're going to say. Now, here's a catch. If you noticed in here that it was the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health, they are the ones, so this is the 2019, they kind of unplugged here from 2019 and gave a separate statement in 2021. Some of the criticisms were like, man, they caved to political pressure. The data hasn't changed. And others said, no, the data has always been there. So we're not going to get into that part. But I just want to tell you that one of those societies that we just covered from 2019 pulled out and gave a revised independent statement in 2021. And that's what we're going to talk about here in just a minute. All right. That's the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. All right. But let's start here. In general, let's just cut to it because we're going to run out of time here. In 2019, here's what they said. Number one, there is no cutoff blood value that can be used for any measured circulating androgen to differentiate women with and without sexual dysfunction. In other words, as we said before, is it 5? Is it 10? Is it 20? We have no number that we can say, oh, it's definitely, quote, unquote, low, and that's causing you a problem. We can say it's low based on a reference range, but we can't tell you that that low value is actually causing the problem. Number two, quote, there is insufficient data to make any recommendations regarding the use of testosterone in premenopausal women for the treatment of sexual function or any other outcome, end quote. So let's stop there. So in 2019, this international consortium said, we're not dealing with premenopause. There's no data there. That changes in 2021 by one society. Okay, so hang on to that. Number three, quote, the only evidence-based indication for testosterone therapy in women is for hypoactive sexual desire disorder. Yeah, they use HSDD as a term, with available data supporting a moderate therapeutic effect only in postmenopausal women, end quote. There it is. And then they go on to say here as we wrap this up, the benefit of testosterone has not been found for cognition, general well-being, depression, bone mineral density, or lean body mass. In other words, for those women, as we said before, trying to bulk up with extra T, that's not going to happen if it's done at physiological dosages. Okay, so that's 2019. Okay, so they said, yes, it could have a role in the short term, only in postmenopause, but you need a baseline level to see where they're at. And as a quinky dink here, as a side note, if their testosterone level is like mid to upper range, don't give them any more. That's obviously not a thing, okay? So even though we don't have a cutoff value of what is considered low, if you've ruled out everything else and it's below the value that we talked about of 15, then potentially consider it. But there's not one blood level we can point to and go, clearly it's low like a TSH, all right? Okay, now that we've done that, we got a boogie here. We got the message from 2021 and then ACOG to go over. So let's do this one next. In 2021, the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health, which was part of the 2019 consortium, guys, they revised their guidance. And their take-home message was very clear. Let's just say it here. Quote, although the global position statement endorses testosterone therapy for only postmenopausal women, notice they're referencing the 2019 publication. They go on to say, quote, limited data, so take that for what it is, limited data also support the use in late reproductive age premenopausal women, end quote. So do you notice those caveats? Limited and late reproductive age. And they go on to say here, quote, this is consistent with the International Society for the Study of Women's Health process of care in the management of hypoactive sexual desire disorder, end quote. So they extended it. Okay, so they pulled out from 2019 and said, I don't know, guys, we don't want women to suffer, which I agree with. Let's bring that down to not just postmenopause, but the late reproductive age, assuming everything else stays the same. And they also endorse only transdermal testosterone. And they state that levels should never be, again, in the supraphysiological range. And the last thing, just as everybody else gives the same disclaimer here, quote, safety data show no serious adverse events with physiologic testosterone use in the short term, but long-term safety has not been established, end quote. Not like long-term safety is questionable or long-term safety seems to be okay. No, it's not established. We don't have that. And since this has real potential issues here, that's where the cause for concern is. So can it help? Yes, but only transdermal, only physiologic doses, only after a thorough workup. And again, only for 3 to 6 months with baseline levels and follow-up serum work at 3 to 6 months. So remember, that baseline is to exclude patients. So if their testosterone level is in the mid to high female range, don't give them any more. It's not going to help. So even though, again, we don't have a cutoff value of what actually is low, it's just kind of inferred, at least try to justify it by having a lower end or below 15 for women to try to make the case, and then follow it up again to 3 to 6 months because it should never be super physiologic. And at that time, it should also include serum lipids, a total cholesterol as well, and throw in, of course, liver function to make sure that nothing else is popping up as abnormal. So the big concerns here, and this is very well stated in ACOG's practice bulletin, which is number 213. Okay, so I'm just going to read it exactly because I can't say it any better than ACOG in its practice bulletin number 213. And we're going to talk about ACOG's final stance here on this subject as we wrap this up. But here is the main area of concern here for all things testosterone in pre or postmenopause, right? So ACOG states, quote, the main adverse effects associated with testosterone therapy in women are hirsutism, acne, virilization, and potential cardiovascular implications. These adverse effects may be irreversible, and long-term safety data are lacking. Yeah, I mean, that word irreversible, y'all, that's scary to me, and patients need to know that, all right? And that's not what's being described on social media channels. Now, ACOG goes on to say, quote, a 2014 systematic review concluded that there was no evidence that transdermal testosterone increased the risk of cardiovascular disease in women in the short term. But the effects of long-term testosterone use on cardiovascular disease risk are just not known. And the last stance is here. The effects of long-term testosterone use, that's defined as greater than 6 months, guys. The effects of long-term testosterone use on breast cancer risk or other cancers is simply unknown at this time. So a lot of questions, and that's the fear here, all right? So now that we've discussed ACOG and we brought them into the mix, let's end the episode by giving ACOG's stance on this. We talked about the stance from 2019 from the International Consortium, 2021 from the International Society for the Study of Women's Health. Now let's get into ACOG and its practice bulletin number 213 that comes from 2019. And then we're going to wrap this up, right? Because this is the end of it. Quote, although there is evidence of benefit for short-term transdermal testosterone therapy in postmenopausal women with low sexual desire. So let's stop there for a minute. Notice that? So it recognizes there's a benefit of transdermal testosterone, but it only states for postmenopausal women. Notice they don't reference premenopause here, guys. That's a clinical pearl. They go on to say, quote, there is not a particular serum level or lower limit of androgens or androgen precursor that is diagnostic of decreased female sexual function, end quote. Yep, okay, we've already covered that. Now, here's the other issue, the rest of the story. ACOG continues, quote, short-term use of transdermal testosterone can be considered as a treatment option for postmenopausal women, there it is again, with sexual interest and arousal disorders who have been appropriately counseled about the potential risks and unknown long-term effects. If transdermal testosterone therapy is used in postmenopausal women, it should be done with a 3 to 6 month trial with reevaluation done at that time with reassessment of testosterone levels to ensure that levels remain within the normal range for reproductive age women, end quote. So ACOG, as of right now, it states that you can try it. You could transdermal only, but you got to check levels. You got to give them risk benefit profile. And according to ACOG, for postmenopause, I'm going to leave it here because there's nothing like stirring the pot, right? Some of you who are doing this in the office are like, sorry, guys, I'm just sticking true to the data. I'm not trying to pick on you. And please don't send me ugly messages because. Okay, I'm just trying to be fair to the data here. ACOG does have a stance here for use of this in premenopause. And here it is, quote, as for premenopausal women, excluding those that have had bilateral oophorectomy, told you so, ACOG states evidence is insufficient to recommend for or against testosterone for the treatment of sexual interest and arousal disorders in premenopausal women, end quote. Now, I know what you're saying. It didn't say not to do it. No, you're right. It did not say not to do it. That's where you've got to take in the 2019, the 2021, and ACOG and pull together from these authorities. There are authoritative guidances, just guidances, and make your decision. Okay. So does everybody agree that there's a potential place for postmenopause? Yes, at least for short term with appropriate dosing and follow-up. Does everybody agree that it's appropriate for premenopausal? No, unless the patient has had bilateral salpingo oophorectomy and the ovaries are gone, where you get a 50% precipitous drop, or if you adhere to the 2021 guidance, it's in late reproductive age where pregnancy is not a concern. And as we wrap this up, DHEA, you can take it if you want to. You can tell your patients to take it. As far as we know, all the data says meh, because while it does work by conversion naturally in the body, taking it by oral form after it goes through its first pass probably is not going to get to where it needs to be for formal conversion to testosterone. So yes, DHEA endogenously in the body does undergo conversion. But as far as we know, supplemental forms, especially oral, not known to increase female sexual interest or arousal. It's just not a thing. And most people agree with that as of today's date. All right, let's go ahead and bring it home. All right, podcast family, that brings us to a wrap. As always, we're thankful for you, and we're glad you're part of our podcast community. We'll see you on another episode of Clinical Pearls.